Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Close Up Talk Radio. We're excited today because a guest we talked with last week, Don Sutherland, is back with us today. And we're going to explore more things with Don. Don is a forensic accountant, and his main goal is trying to track down people who are doing criminal things, bad things. As you may know, criminals can commit all sorts of financial crimes, that's including fraud, money laundering, insider dealing, and even embezzlement. And, you know, they do this in all sorts of ways with banks and individuals. Things have been widespread and a problem for decades, and it impacts all of us, and it's only getting worse these days. And the kind of people who can track down individuals who are doing those kind of crimes is exactly what our guest Don Sutherland does. He is a forensic accountant. Amazingly and interestingly, he had 12 years with the FBI, a former FBI agent who does many things now, but he is serving as a forensic accountant. He also serves as an expert witness in criminal trials, where his testimony is very important in helping convince juries that they're on the right track and convicting the right person. Anyway, Don has an amazing background. It was a wonderful conversation last week, so we've invited him back again. And for those of you who did not hear that conversation, I'll get him to repeat a little bit because I think you'll find it very, very interesting. We know what an accountant is, but we're going to ask Don what a forensic accountant is. There's a big difference. Don is based in the Dallas suburb of Plano. Hello, Don. Welcome. Good morning. How are you? Welcome back to Close Up Talk Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug. Glad to be here.
You are welcome. I got to ask you, is it still pretty hot in Plano? Been hot down in Dallas, hasn't it?
It is. It is. It was 109 here yesterday.
There you go, 109 degrees in Texas. Hopefully you'll get some cool weather soon, but I know it's been scorching lately. In any event, as I just pointed out, you are a forensic accountant. Explain to our audience exactly what that means. What do you do, okay?
Realistically, a forensic accounting, or what I do, is investigative accounting. I know the term forensic accounting has expanded over the years to include economical damages. I don't do that. I do simple fraud investigations using investigative accounting. My definition includes having a background in law enforcement, understanding criminal statutes, and also having my CPA in accounting, being able to look at the rules of accounting and combining the two.
Well, you know, you pointed out, and we talked about the fact that you knew really early on in your life, I recall saying something like at the age of 14, you were interested in being an accountant, and you actually began work for your dad as a bookkeeper at 14. Is that right?
I did. I started working for him as a bookkeeper, and at the age of 15 in high school, I took a bookkeeping class, and then I took my first college courses in accounting during my senior year in high school. So I was pretty confirmed early in life to take up this role in my career.
So to get your credentials as an accountant, I'm interested because, as I recall, You were courted by the FBI while you were in college. Isn't that the case? Am I right on that?
Yes. During career day in my senior year in college, the FBI did come to our school, as they did all schools, and put a bug in everyone's ear that they were recruiting different fields. Accounting was one that they were particularly seeking at the time. And the only caveat was you had to have 2 years of business experience before they could hire you. But they went ahead our senior year in college and let us know that opportunity existed.
What attracted your interest in the FBI? I would think that would have been very flattering to you at the time. What did they say or describe? What did they make, you know, how did they make it sound like that would be a good career path?
Well, they talked about fraud cases that they had. They needed accountants to go out and do financial crimes. They also expanded on that and said, but you'll work everything. You'll work bank robbers. You'll work drug cases. You'll work whatever the Bureau works. You'll be out there working those violations. But they had a particular interest in accountants coming in and handling the financial crimes part of the investigations.
They made it sound kind of exciting, didn't they? Seriously.
Sure they did.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, and it hasn't changed, you know, they still do the same thing. So you did work in, even though you had worked for your father at the age of 15, I gather you worked for a couple of years as a CPA and then went to the FBI. Is that about it, if that's a requirement?
I did. I worked 5 years out in the so-called real world. In
yeah.
both oil and gas and the healthcare industries before I joined the Bureau.
So tell me a little bit about what you did in the Bureau. You are an accountant. Is a forensic accountant? Do you have additional training that a normal accountant doesn't have, or is it just what you do makes you a forensic accountant? How do you answer that?
I think the additional training is the training I received in the FBI as to doing investigations. So as opposed to a regular accountant that hasn't worked in law enforcement, I've had extensive training in how and experience in conducting criminal investigations and going through the legal process on a criminal trial. That's the main difference with me with a pure accountant out there. I still have the accounting background, but I've added the investigative side to it.
So you retired from the FBI, and you're still doing that now, the forensic accountant work now, and I know you work as an expert witness for law firms, I guess, primarily, who contact you to assist them in the cases that they have. Let's talk a little bit about that, and then we'll get into the criminal aspect of. But as a you know, an expert witness, tell me what your role is and how you serve in that capacity.
Well, I'm hired by both lawyers and individuals or companies that have been, for the most part, they've been defrauded in some way or fashion. Usually individuals or companies, it's embezzlement. They've had an employee that's for years had a fraudulent scheme to steal money from them. Individuals have several different ways that they have been defrauded, like investment schemes and things of that nature. And then just regular attorneys, they have what most of it with attorneys is civil litigation, but there are also criminal investigations as well. But they are handling the civil side of the case, and while I might be an expert in their civil litigation, I'm usually working up a criminal referral to law enforcement at the same time.
Very interesting. Let me ask you a little bit about how technology has changed the way you do your work. I would assume with what all has gone on since you began working for the FBI, there's been a huge change, hasn't there? Or am I wrong?
Oh, sure. There's been a huge change. When I was in the Bureau in my first office in 1987, that office received its first standalone computer to do. And I got one of them. Well, we got three of them in the office, and I got one of them to do financial crimes on. Today, that's kind of every kid out there in school has a computer. So to have an office of about 100 agents and one computer given to one agent is a huge change that we've gone through since just 1987.
Yeah, not only just one computer, but the computers themselves have become so much more sophisticated than those of back in the early 80s. There's no question about that. How do you go about doing your work? Let's say you have you've got cases you could describe for me, but how do you do that? Explain how you do your work. Let's say you're brought in by someone who feels, you know, their employees or someone are embezzling money from them. How do you go about tracking this down to see if they have or not?
Well, in most cases, the only way you can really do it is to get the financial documents, their bank record, the company's bank records, a lot of their other type supporting documents, their sales invoices, their purchase receipts, things of that nature. And if it's a business that deals in large cash volume, then it becomes very difficult to try to determine what cash would be stolen. But you have to take some very exorbitant methods to determine that. Let me give you a quick example. I had a client that owned a little corner convenience store, and attached to that convenience store, they had a car wash that only took quarters. It was back before they take credit cards or anything of that nature, or you bought it at the count, bought your coat at the counter, anything like that. You just had to put quarters in it. And they thought they were making X number of dollars per month off that car wash. And after we determined that their chief bookkeeper was stealing a large amount of monies in other ways in the convenience store and fired her, then we started looking at the collections on the car wash and noticed that about the revenue from the car wash is more than doubled than what they had thought they had been receiving in previous months and years and things like that. So we had to do some extra steps to try to come up with a calculation as to the amount of money that she stole when we took it to federal court and charged her with tax fraud and embezzlement and things of that nature.
You know, I'm prompted to ask you about the cases that you worked on, some of the cases you worked on with the FBI. Take me through some of those. You don't have to mention any names of anyone, but it must have been very, very interesting for you, and I'm sure some of those cases took a rather, you know, a large amount of time for you before you tracked down what you were looking for. Give me some idea of some of those cases. Could you do that?
Well, sure. I worked quite a few bank fraud and investment schemes, commonly known as Ponzi scheme cases. Most of my cases when I was in the Bureau, I was the sole agent assigned to them. And so they would take 2 to 3 years on some of these larger Ponzi schemes. I did a $60 million Ponzi scheme out in Hawaii that was the largest scheme of that type back in the late 80s. And they're very paper intensive, and with numerous investors around the country, they take a while to go out and get your witnesses and conduct your analysis, your financial analysis on them. But the biggest case I worked in the Bureau was called the BCCI case. It was major case number 13 in the Bureau. And those case, that case, the number 13, that was in succession to like the John F. Kennedy murder and the Dillinger case that had those same types of designations as a major case. That case I only worked on for a year because we had multiple agents working that case, but I was one of three co-case agents on that. We had overlap in some of what we did, like the bank fraud, and some of it, like the corruption side of it, I did by myself or with agents, agents working with me, not the co-case agents, but other agents working with me. And we had a very, we were rushed to do that investigation because of its sensitivity and its publicity. I think I mentioned last time, Robert Mueller was our DOJ attorney on the case. We're investigating former Secretary of States and the head of the Republican National Party and several other well-known government officials for their influence they used to let foreigners come in and buy American banks, which was against the law here in the United States. We don't let foreigners own banks in the United States. So, but
it's interesting they can buy land, but they can't buy banks, huh? No kidding. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah,
that's right. So we did the largest forfeiture ever. We did $1 billion forfeiture, of which half of that went to the United States and half of it went to Great Britain on that case. So it was a huge banking fraud case.
Explain a little bit. I know obviously that was very complex. Explain a little bit about the kind of stuff you had to do on a case like that. Because, you know, people have the feeling that you're just sitting behind the desk looking at papers all the time, you know, like an accountant counting figures and numbers. But there's a lot more to it than that. Give us some idea of exactly how you worked and what you had to do.
Okay. Well, there is a lot of time spent looking at documents. In fact, we had over 30,000 bankers' boxes of records over in DOJ there in Washington, D.C. So I never went to the FBI.
30,000 boxes? 30,000 boxes?
Just at DOJ there in D.C. We had more boxes around the world that we had to go look at, but those were the primary boxes that I looked at. And we were going through those looking for what you call the smoking gun, finding that letter or that communication that you would you could use in the case to prove someone's innocent or guilt, whatever it be. That was the first case that DOJ, to my knowledge, and I'm pretty sure they advertised as first case they ever did, where they scanned all those records into a database so they could, quote, easily search them for names and other types of things, words, so to speak, but mainly names. And what they failed to identify, and this is what you learn in investigation, is good ideas aren't always great ideas. What we learned in that case is that most of the names were Middle Eastern, from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. They're like the heritage of Hispanics. They have numerous names, and they sign their name different ways based upon the type of communication they're doing. If it's a personal letter, they sign it with their middle name last or first name last or something like that. There's different orders of their name. And if it's a business record, they sign it in a completely different way. And then you come back to the fact that they have so many names that a lot of them have the same name. A good example people would understand today is if we were doing it on the Indian Asian culture and you said Patel, there's many of them here in the United States that at one point of their name is Patel. And so
right.
If you did a search on them, if we did a search even on the main subject and two main subjects in this case, we would come up with 1 million hits, which came out to be almost useless to have done
it.
And anybody else that we actually searched in that were main names of the cases, it was not useful. So we had to physically go through each box of records and look at each piece of document to see if it was relevant to the case, evidence that we needed to pull out. And then you follow that up with interviews, and that's probably the primary or second primary essence of the case. You have to go out and interview the people regarding that document. What did it mean? And if they wrote it or if they received it, what did that document mean to them? And who else knew about it? And what's the principle of it? And so we went around the world doing that. I didn't go outside the country at that time. There were other agents going around the world and looking at other documents and talking to people and things of that nature. But I spent most of my time here in the United States doing the corruption side of the investigation.
And you spent a full year on that. Is that right?
That's correct.
Wow. That's a lot for one case. But what eventually happened? How did it all work out? What was the end result of all that work?
Well, our primary case, we indicted quite a few people. The most notable was were two partners in the bank in Washington, D.C. One had been the Secretary of State for two Democratic presidents, and one of the partners was the head of the Republican National Party at the time. And we never got to trial on them. The Manhattan DA's office under Mr. Morgenthau also had a case against them, and he wanted to proceed with his case. Unfortunately, by the time his case came to court, Mr. Morgenthau was up in his, I believe he's already up in his 90s and unable to go to court. I'm sorry, not Mr. Morgenthau. The former Secretary of State was too old to go to court. And his partner went to court and got acquitted because they found that New York had not been defrauded with the representations made by those individuals to the Federal Senate, Federal Banking Committee. So
it turned out to be a good result. By the way, you just mentioned that. How old do you have to be too old to go to court to be charged with a crime?
You just have to be incapacitated as a witness be able to appear in court.
Okay, all right. you know, I'm fascinated by one other thing. We started to talk a little bit about this last week. You talk about corruption being everywhere, and you said even in the administration of our schools. And I gather this is something that you are looking into these days. Is that right? You talk about mismanagement by school boards, that it's a staggering reality. Talk to me about that.
Okay. Probably for the last 10 years, I have spent quite a bit of time working for school districts, looking at fraud and corruption in their school. Since in the last 2 or 3 years, I constantly get called by citizens who are looking at their school boards and their districts and saying what they're doing is criminal, it's not right, and I try to advise them It's very hard not working for the school district to try to help an individual citizen. But the work we've done from within the school has been grade cheating scandals out in El Paso to misuse of bond funds down in another school district, and then numerous other school district investigations by their federal grant programs that they've mismanaged or things of that nature. Unfortunately, what I've been getting calls on the past 3 years are just mismanagement of districts by their board of directors, and it's the stories are just staggering as to the corruption that's going through school districts by these board members right now. Texas's Department of Education is taking over numerous school districts right now because they're financial failures. And the ones I've looked at, their financial failures are caused by the boards going out and making not only bad financial decisions, but what looks like corrupt financial decisions in many cases, so that either they or some family member benefit from it. And so that seems to be very prevalent, not only in Texas. I've received calls from people in Michigan, Arkansas, other states like that.
Wow, that's very – and that, I guess it's really hard to know that that's going on if you don't have it. You just have to suspect that something's going on. Is that what happens? So people say, look, this doesn't smell right. We've got to investigate this. And it's other people on the school board are bringing this to your attention. Is that how it works? Is that right?
In some cases, that's exactly how it is. If a school board member, it's usually one that's in the minority that's seeing this corruption, they'll call me and discuss it with me as to what they should do or what they should be looking for or how they should handle the corruption that they've discovered within the district by either the board or by the superintendent or both. And
wow. No, that's very interesting that you get heavily involved in that. Let me ask you, what advice would you give people in the general public if you think they may become victims of financial crime? What would you suggest they do?
I suggest that they contact law enforcement first and let them know. At the same time, law enforcement has their hands so tied up these days with so many different issues that it really takes someone in my field, a good forensic accountant or a certified fraud examiner, call one of these people to help you write a report and gather the evidence to take to law enforcement so that they're more able to take action that they need to take to hold those people accountable.
Well, I think that's very good advice indeed. Don, time just flies when we're talking to you. We're talking to Don Sutherland, Jr. He's based in the Dallas suburb of Plano. If you're interested, if you have need, you could certainly get in touch with Don at his email, which is dsutherland@4acc.net. It's short for forensic. So it's foracc.net. Again, his name is D. Sutherland, Jr. at 4acc.net. Don, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been amazing. Thank you for being our guest. Okay? We appreciate it. You've been great.
You have been listening
thank
to a broadcast
Dad.
From Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.